Welcome to episode 146 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read From Hell by Alan Moore. And now, the cast begins.
It was good. It was just like 600 fucking pages.
Yeah.
Ready?
Yeah.
All right, everybody, welcome to a murderous episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hello.
And Jen.
Hey.
And this week we read From Hell because it was a listener request. This one was written by Alan Moore with art by Eddie Campbell, and this is a graphic novel from 1989. So, first thing I want to say is I think it's important that we call this a graphic novel because I get the feeling like, you know, there's comic books and trade paperbacks, but then there are those snooty people who say, oh, I don't read comics. I read graphic novels. I think this is, like, the first thing they put on their shelf.
Because, damn, this was long.
This thing is so big.
I was not prepared for this. Well, then when we got it, I was like, oh, okay, well, I'll read this. But when I got it, I was like, holy crap.
Dude, I sat down on Sunday at like noon in my cool little hand chair to try and read this thing. And I was like, I'll just knock it out in like 2 or 3 hours, whatever. I know it's long, but 2 or 3 hours. It was 5 o'clock and I was like halfway through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a heavy book.
Because it's not just Tomaic. It's also, I mean, there's action in this, but it's almost all talking.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talking in this and that just makes it so much longer.
Some of it is easy to go through, but for instance, like chapter 4, the whole thing where he takes Netley through London and shows him the monuments, that was crazy.
That was the longest, it felt like the longest part for me too.
Yeah.
You know what that reminded me of the most? That reminded me of when we read, during the Alan Moore arc, when we read Prometheum.
Promethea.
That's right, Promethea. I really, really like that comic. I just didn't like that there was the one issue in the middle where Alan Moore just took the entire issue to explain how magic worked and how, like, Prometheus' power worked, and just it was just a whole comic of explanation. And this, like, reminded me of that so much. And he encased it in the, oh, we're taking a little tour around London kind of carriage thing. But, like, it was just, oh, God, I get it. This guy is fucking off his rocker.
Yeah. Alan Moore is a verbose comics author.
Yes.
Like, for sure.
And I mean, that chapter, I think they're called chapters in this, that chapter played a good function in that it really set the, like, occult setting that was going after this. Because before that chapter, there's, like, just kind of weird stuff. But, like, this heavy occult Masonic thing isn't really present until that chapter onward. So, yeah. I mean, it serves a purpose in the story, but, like, I don't think it had to be so heavy.
Yeah, I think it does build mysticism throughout, which, I think it's a character portrait of Gull.
Yeah.
And I just ripped that from Wikipedia, so I admit that right now. But
whatever works.
He really is driven to do these things by the strange obsession with, you know, Masonic practices and overcoming Dionysian insanity with Apollonian logic. And he feels like all of London is put together in this logical order, and, you know, he's curing a disease of insanity within London, that is the East End, and bringing order to London. So I think this architecture that he points out is kind of in part what drives his crazy.
Yeah, and I think his crazy is that certain kind where he is really interested in this stuff and he wants to see it everywhere. So then when he walks around town, he sees it everywhere, and it just kind of reinforces the beliefs that he already has. You know, like, what was it? The street that they dumped the first girl on was Bucks something or other, Bucks Road, or Bucksville, or something like that, Bucks something. And he had to make the comment, like, oh, just like Diana's favorite beast or something. And it's like, also maybe just a deer. We are in England.
Yeah, but we never really, I mean, he makes such a compelling case for this Masonic symbolism mixed into the architecture and layout of London that it's almost believable, you know? I found myself being like, okay, I could see what you're saying there, Dr. Gull. And so when those kinds of things came up, like the Buck's Row or whatever, I forget what it was called as well.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, that's I could see. You were right all along, crazy person.
So a cool thing, because I didn't read the appendices, but I did skim them, is that this stuff was actually all in London at the time. The map does work out. Alan Moore used Victorian maps of the day wherever possible. So I think, you know, they had London fully mapped at that time, obviously, because it was the capital. And so this stuff was real, and Alan Moore even got in his car and made the journey himself just to make sure that it could be done in one day.
That's freaking amazing.
Yeah, that's research.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that kind of dedication. But, I mean, even though we see him do this whole thing and we're thinking, yeah, you're kind of right, but you're also kind of fucking insane, dude. At the end, he's actually completely validated, right? Because in the end, the Masonic Order is so powerful, it consumes even him, even though he's the one who knows it all and he's the one who's actually had the vision, you know? And it's like, yeah, sure, Hart, whatever makes you have a vision, he had a vision, and that brought him into inspiration exactly the way the Masons are supposed to do it. And so it's like, after all of that stuff and all of us as the reader not really believing him, he's kind of right in the end. The Masonic Order is so powerful in this comic that, I mean, it's all the way to the Queen, all the way down to the constables tossing Mr. Druitt in the river.
Right. I mean, but what I meant, I guess, is not that that what he was saying didn't like validate the power of the Masons, but what I meant is like there was nothing else in the comic that validated what he said about all these Masonic symbols mixed in.
Yeah.
And that I guess that's what I meant.
Yeah, and his obsession with that one architect.
Yeah, because he might have just been, putting that stuff in there, right?
Yeah.
But in another case, it could be that we don't know for sure that really is why the city is laid out that way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So how did all this occult stuff work with you guys? Did it work for you at all reading the comic? Was it a neat thing that you felt added to the story? Or
I think that it was really cool that Alan Moore did all the research and that he gave his character a really crazy reason for being crazy. Because sometimes we see, like, people going crazy for various tropes, like a loved one dies, or, you know, they feel jilted in some way and need revenge, or they're just evil. But here, he is evil, but he's trying to bring order and rightness to England, and he even says, like, ooh, the Illuminati are threatening us. And like, I didn't see that threat, but I think it's supposed to be like that, where he has this vision, and we're supposed to see buildings. I think we're supposed to be in Netley's shoes in this sense and say, you know, this is crazy. This is really weird. Why is this even, like, a thing that you're bringing up? And it's supposed to make us feel like Gull is even more crazy.
Kitty. Yeah, and I like the irony of his character and how he goes around and he spends that entire chapter lecturing Netley about the war between logic and reason and the insanity of the woman, right? And I like the irony of him doing all of that, and while he's on that carriage, he's so convinced he's going from the Apollonian logical side. But in the end, he's the one who loses that battle with himself. He ends up completely insane.
Yeah.
I love that about this guy.
He never sees it either. He thinks that he's found purity of thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's ascended to a higher plane.
To an office in 1985.
Oh, God. Yeah.
That was so awkward.
That was weird. I don't know what to think of that. Because that's beyond a cult. That's Alan Moore right there.
Well, that's Alan Moore saying this guy really, and this character really did have this vision. I mean, that kind of...
That might be Alan Moore's dig at, you know, current culture.
Yeah. About the immodesty of women and how even the people walking around in offices are...
Well, I feel like his comics often make a commentary on the time that they're set in, you know? Because V for Vendetta was similar in that it was making a commentary on the time. So, you know, this probably has something to do with that, too, and Watchmen as well. That was, you know, that was the commentary on superhero comics of the day. So, you know, I feel like what I'm trying to say is Alan Moore doesn't just say things or just doesn't toss things in there. I think everything has a definite meaning within the story.
Yeah, and there's some times when I really appreciate that he does that. And then there's other times where I feel like I'm just in over my head. Like when there's a song going on in the background and I'm like, that probably is meaningful somehow, but I don't know what it is. Or like when they read a poem in the middle of the story, I'm like, that's kind of... I think I get it. I don't know. But that might also be my own fault because, like, each chapter opened with, like, a bunch of quotes. I skipped those pages.
I read them, but like you, I wasn't really familiar with many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, some of them, for all of them, I could see how they tied in. Like, when he quoted Oscar Wilde in the scene, where the man gets flipped up into the river, that is like a clear correlation with Druitt, or the issue with who was it, the guy who runs the British Museum saying it was the mummy that started the war. And Gull goes into the British Museum and is like, get that fucking mummy, you know. I think part of it is to tie in this idea, like when we see Gull ascend, we see that the thing that Hinton says in Hawkmoor's church, the one that they visit, it is true that there is a set trajectory in history that is built or shaped by, like, the great Masonic architect, because we see Gull murdering these women, and even before that, in, I think, 1788 or something, he witnesses a previous murder, and it, like, all connects together all the way through to, like, the 1970s.
Yeah, that fourth dimension stuff.
Yeah, so we see it all come together, and I think Moore is trying to tie those chapter openings in to the greater scheme of history, because he uses Oscar Wilde, and he uses Blake, and says these people were related. So I think he's trying to show us that Gull was correct in that there is a true Masonic idea of a grand architecture of the universe, which I think it actually does kind of work, because you see, like, maybe Gull is right, but at the same time he's doing this thing that is so revolting and we think he's crazy. So it's one of those, like, is he crazy or are we crazy type of things.
Right, I think it's somewhere in between. I think the brother Masons who try him at the end, I think they're right. They're like, dude, we did ask you to do this, but we didn't ask you to, like, mutilate these women. We didn't ask you to take out hearts and burn them, and all of this stuff that you were doing, that's sick. Like, you are sick. The other stuff, killing them, we did ask you to do that. That is our own fault. And we will not kill you because we asked you to do that. And we would obviously be wrong. But, like, dude, you're going too far. Way too far. So I think the sanity is, like, somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it that he's crazy by normal people's standards. But, I think you're right, Andy. It's somewhere in between.
So what did we think of... I mean, we talked already about how long this book was. Do you think it was long and good, or do you think it was long and verbose, or do you think it was... Because, I mean, this story is really complex. All of these characters interweaving, all of these people, and the way their lives intersect in odd ways, it makes for a very, very big story. And is that good? Does that work for you?
I think... So, when I first started reading it, you know, it starts with the prologue with Aberlane and Lee's in their old age, in their retirement. I wasn't sure what to think at that point, so I was just like, okay, we're going to do this. I'll keep reading, keep reading. I got to chapter 4, and that, we talked about this a little bit already, but it's really a heavy chapter, and it kind of drags on. You're flipping through it, and you're like, okay, when are we going to get to the end of this?
Yeah.
And so I thought, so at that point, I was like not enjoying the, I was not enjoying the experience of reading the book. It was interesting, but I wasn't ready. But after chapter 4, I kind of flew through the rest of the book. It really picked up steam, and I really started to enjoy it. Especially when I'm not, like when the murder started happening, and then when Aberlane comes in, and he's a very interesting character. I liked him a lot. I think at first I was not, I didn't love it, but as I got further into it, it's really started to like it a lot.
Yeah, I really agree. For me, it, like that prologue, you get Aberlane and Lee's, and I'm like, okay, these guys are, their interactions really neat, and like, what did they do that made them take the pension, and what kind of moral questions come up with them that I'm going to have to grapple with? And it's like, it takes 5 chapters to get to Aberlane. And
yeah, you know, sorry to cut in there, but I actually had forgotten about Lee's
by
the
too.
Time he came up. I
me
forgot
too.
That he was in the prologue.
Yeah.
But it's like it took until Aberlane got in there and the investigation started for me to really get interested in this comic. Because I think that the buildup for this is really slow.
Yes.
But I think it's important to lay out Gull as a full character so that you can see him go from this kid on the boat saying, I want to have one great work that only the Lord will see, to his complete madness at the end, and using that thought when he was a kid to rationalize his actions like 40, 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's important, I think, to see that complete arc of this character. But yeah, that chapter 4 just it, like, okay, we're building up, and drag, and then we're off and running again.
Yeah, I feel like this is a story that requires fortitude, because the payoff at the end is really good.
Oh my god, yeah.
But you really have to endure the build up, and the beginning, it's not bad, but it feels like something I want to read at a very leisurely pace. Thing that this actually reminded me of was like reading something for a class, like when you're handed a book and you say, here's the time limit, get it done, and it felt like homework a little bit, so that was a bit of a deterrent. But you know, by the end, I feel like if I had a month to just peruse this and like kind of get really wrapped up in it and catch all the little details, you know, that's a really good story to do that with.
Yeah, especially the way things interweave and all that kind of good stuff.
I actually wanted to take some time and look into this, the Jack the Ripper crimes and stuff too, just to see what where Alan Moore, you know, where the reality was and what part of it was his fiction. Because I haven't really looked into, I don't know much about this crime spree other than that it was, as far as I know, it went unsolved, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this
about as much as I know too.
I wanted to go and read more of it before we started before we recorded this podcast, but I didn't get a chance to.
So, just a warning, and a warning to like anybody else out there, because I made this mistake. I kept trying to read this over lunch and dinner, and I like to reference outside material when I read. Holy shit. Okay, do not look at the murder pictures of Mary Kelly. And do not do it while you're eating. I will say, Eddie Campbell, the artist?
Yes.
Just blanked there for a second. Eddie Campbell recreated the Mary Kelly crime scene in full detail, and it's insanely horrifying. Like, I'm feeling shaken up just talking about it right now, because remembering what I saw. So unless you really want to subject yourself to that when you do your research, don't look at those pictures. They're awful.
Yeah, if she ends up looking anything like what Eddie Campbell shows when she's getting dissected, I have no desire to ever look at that. Like, I got queasy. I was finishing the last of this while I was eating dinner. I was having guacamole and chips for dinner, and I had to set the chips aside and wait and finish that chapter and then read the next one, and then I was okay. And I could start eating again.
It's just as bad. It's, if not worse, just... I mean, I definitely commend Eddie Campbell for his attention to detail, but whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, we talked about how it's a big story. How did we feel about the last couple chapters? Because we've already said it's a big story. Is the payoff worth it?
I think so. I think that when I got to the Ascension of Goal chapter... Mm-hmm. That I was going to be disappointed because it was going to get, like, too weird. Like, you know how, almost Grant Morrison style, where mm-hmm. he gives you, like, this really cool thing and then the payoff, like, you can't actually understand it because it's too strange. This felt very straightforward in comparison to a lot of weirdness we see in comics. And I enjoyed that. It was basically, like, a crazy man. And then, you know, we think that he's right. And that we're seeing his grand vision and that it's true and he did attain enlightenment. And then in the end, he doesn't go to heaven. He doesn't see, like, the grand being. He ends up back in the little room and his last moments are watching two of the people who take care of him have sex.
Yeah.
So I felt like that made it really come full circle, and I feel like that was the most astute punishment for him to realize that all of this that he's done didn't pan out and that it wasn't real and that he didn't meet God and learn his true name.
And it's all just as worthless as he was fighting against. Like, all these symbols that he finds around London, all of this, he draws the star and all those other things, and it's like none of that will amount to anything. For 99% of the people living on this earth, they're just going to keep fucking and having kids and the world will grow and it won't matter. None of these symbols matter. And that ending is perfect for him. You're right. I also really love the moment when Aberline puts everything together when he goes to that that candy shop.
Oh yeah.
He just happens to go in there and I'm like, holy shit, that's right, the fucking candy shop. Oh my god. And the other guy's just making gossip. And you're like, dude, you're gonna get fucking murdered.
Well, that's the saddest part. This guy knows. It's like everybody knows it's the town gossip. Nobody gives a shit. Meaning nobody had to die.
Yeah. It was all worthless. Well, not worth. It was all just, like, for nothing. Just these four poor women who were just already so downtrodden had to die for nothing.
Well... What did you think of the fact that Mary Kelly seems to have lived?
I kind of like it.
You don't mind that it, like, deviates so strongly from, like, the source material?
I mean, there's a lot in this that I think deviates from the source
material. Oh, yeah, that's true. Absolutely true.
I think it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it makes it so that his warning, oh god, what was his name? Was that Lise that gave the warning? No. The prince's gay, yeah, Sickert. It makes it so that his warning wasn't in vain. Because that moment when he came and warned her just tore me apart. When she was like, why are you even fucking telling me? What is 2 days gonna do? What? Oh my god, now I know in 2 days I'm gonna be like, that moment was like, and but he's right, like he knows, and the right thing to do is to try and warn her.
Yeah, but, for sure.
But what is... what? I mean, she can't even afford carriage out of town, probably.
Except she borrowed the money.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and I loved that it turned out that she was Emma. That was so good.
It tied together just right. And I like that certain set of circumstances worked out for her. Because otherwise this is... Otherwise, this entire comic is so dark and dirty, and the fact that she makes it out.
Did you notice what she named her kids?
No, I didn't catch it.
She named her daughters after the three other whores who died.
Yeah.
Aww. It
was Paul, Polly,
Polly, Liz, and was Annie one of them?
Annie was the one that got...
Annie was the pregnant one.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a second Annie? They do the standard, I'm British and I lived before 1900.
Mary?
There were two Marys and Liz and...
I think it was like Mary and Marie.
Yeah, Marie Kelly.
Marie Kelly and then
Except
Mary.
She was also Mary. Because if you were in the working class before a certain point in time and didn't know how to read, your name was subject to change whenever you wanted it to be.
Yeah.
So one of the Marys was definitely also called Paul, I think. Polly.
Yeah. They, even in this one, a lot of them had different names. Like, and I think that plays into the feeling for them, too. Like, almost like we know them because we're getting this view of them. But at a certain point, their names don't even really matter. They're not even really people. They live in this world, but they don't have a place to sleep. They don't know where their food's coming from. Like, we get to know them, and that's why we get the attachment and why we bother to learn their names. But aside from the guy running the bar, nobody else really needs to know their name or give a crap about them.
Yeah.
And I think like that interchangeable of their names in just this just helps underscore that.
It's kind of funny, too, because there's a lot of confusion about who gets murdered sometimes. Like, they say, you know, there's even a scene in an Inquisition where an old woman is like, yeah, that's my daughter, Elizabeth such and such. And they're like, no, this is Elizabeth other such and such. And she goes, oh, my bad. And it's like, you don't know your own daughter? So, I mean, they're just kind of these ghosts of people. And it makes you really wonder, who is the poor schlub that got murdered in place of Mary Kelly?
Yeah, that's
well,
just...
she brought two other women into the little room before someone gets murdered. Right? It was Julia. It could have been that Julia person.
We see Julia alive later.
Oh, right. Well, there was also the Maria. Yeah. That was the person Julia brought, right?
Yeah, so
no,
it must have been...
No, no, Marie brought Mary... Mary Kelly brought Maria in, and then Julia came in and was like, oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, God, the names. Do we get any sense of character for these women? I mean, like I said before, we get to know them, so we attach to them, and we bother to learn their names. But I think in my head, most of their character is interchangeable, almost. And I get to know them not because they matter to me as people, but because they matter to me as pawns in this story.
I feel like I got to know Liz because she kept talking about her farm back in Sweden.
Yeah.
And then there was another one who dreamt of the church doors opening and the blood coming out. Later, it might have even been Lee's. Someone says, I had the same dream and I dreamt that the war is coming. I don't remember who said that, but it's like they share a dream. So I don't remember who dreamt that, though. So Liz was memorable. And then I think Mary Kelly was memorable just for the sake of her epic breakdown when she realized she was going to die.
Yeah. And then the one that Aberline got attached to, yeah. That helps,
too. Well, that's Mary Kelly, right?
Yeah.
The real Mary Kelly.
Yeah. And I think that helps establish her character even more, you know, just because we get the sense that she... I don't know, that she just needs somebody to appreciate her. You know, like, that's all that any of these women needed. I mean, they talk about needing a place to sleep and all of that, but... Like, I don't think she takes for granted what Aberline does for her. And I think even though she runs off with his money, like, she takes the time to leave him a note. Right? Like, you're going to die in 2 days. Oh, I got to go write a note. You know, I would just fucking run right then and there. Just leave town that moment.
Yeah, I think... I like to think that maybe she loved him a little. I mean...
I think at the end, when he specifically says... Okay, we can fuck now. I think when he says that, it's a little bit telling about him and his character. But I think it's also telling about her that she had just not even considered it for so long. that she had grown to think of him more as that friend. And then when he brings it up, she doesn't say, oh, yeah, yeah, right, I owe you, or anything in those terms. She says, oh, yeah, of course, that's a fine celebration, you know?
Yeah.
I think when she says, yes, of course, she's startled because she's so used to him not seeing her that way. But after that initial moment of being startled, it's genuine. Like, she would genuinely make love to him.
Isn't that also... Do you remember the Johnny Depp movie from, like, 2009?
Actually, I was going to ask you guys if you had seen... It's actually from 2001.
That old? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I looked it up a little, but I haven't watched... I haven't actually seen the movie.
Wait, what movie is it?
From Hell.
From Hell. It's based on this. Really? It stars Johnny Depp, but it focuses more on the lead inspector's love affair with the... Well, with Mary Kelly.
Yeah, Johnny Depp is Aberline, according to Wikipedia.
Totally different type of character, though. He's, like, a complete fucking opium addict, and just, like, it's very different. It's not this at all.
He played Johnny Depp, then.
You know, I really like, when I hear stuff like that, it makes me completely understand why Alan Moore hates when his comics get turned into movies.
Yeah.
Because Aberline, until that moment, and only that moment, and the very end, those are the only times we see his character falter at all. I mean, up until that point, he is a good cop, just trying to solve this murder, and he's following his gut and
everything.
He's
probably the best cop we see.
Yeah. He's probably the best person we see in this comic.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of morals and actions and... And the only time we see him falter is for that moment when he's willing to commit adultery on his wife. I think because he develops genuine care for this woman.
Yeah, and I don't think that makes him a terrible person, because he doesn't... I mean, he's willing to go through with it, but then, you know, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
He also specifically says, like, he had a first wife that died, and he is a widower, and that he married his second wife out of convenience, not love.
Well, I think he said married for a career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something like that. But he did say, you know, she's a good woman, good wife, all that kind of, you know, she's great, but, you know, just for the career. And at the very end, of course, the fact that he takes the pension and stays quiet, but I don't even really think we can fault him for that, because once he sees how grand this conspiracy is, that it comes down from the queen, even, it's like, well, I mean, I want to stand up for my morals too, but who's going to listen? you're gonna be dead.
He didn't really have any other option, right? I mean, he would have been, if he had turned on the queen, that could have been treason, right?
Oh yeah,
it would have been treason. And at that point, you also gotta consider, this is after so much of it had been considered solved and moved on from, and this, that, and the other thing. Even if he does come out, I mean, how believable is he even going to be? If he comes out raving, oh, it was a huge conspiracy with the Masonic Order and the Queen, and it's like, okay, yeah, buddy. No, this guy drowned in the lake or in a river. Occam's razor, buddy. No, you're just crazy. And then he gets murdered anyway.
Yeah, it's not worth throwing away his life.
Yeah. So, I mean, we see him falter twice, but I can't blame him for either one, really.
No, he's a pretty stand-up guy, and I think... that works really well against Gull. Because, I mean, Gull is like a bona fide freaking psychopath. We see him cutting up dead animals as a kid, and, you know, we see, like, the really creepy wedding night that he has, and then, you know, there's just, like, all these little negative, like, ooh, you're not supposed to like this guy, portraits of him throughout the comic. And we see Aberline, and... we see all these reasons that we should like him, so...
You know, the moment I bought into Aberline was... I don't want to say it was the very first scene. Not right when he gets transferred, but when he goes home. Like, when he tells the guy at Scotland Yard, like, yes, no question, sir, thank you, sir, for the assignment. And then he goes home and just sits on the couch silently. And his wife goes, what's up? What's up, buddy? And he goes, 14 years. 14 fucking years. And they're sending me back right after I finally get out. They're sending me back to Whitechapel. I cannot fucking believe this. And I'm like, oh, buddy, I hate my job too. Like, in that moment, I completely sympathize and buy in with him and his character, because that just makes him human, especially after seeing especially after we see Sir William Goal and his completely crazy diatribe in chapter 4. Like, oh, this guy's hella normal. we're going to be buddies. I'm going to go through this story with you. I'm picking you out. And that really helps tie me into him as a character.
Definitely. I think, I mean, we just get a lot more of him too, right? Because he's one of the very few people whose head we really get inside.
Mm-hmm.
We see more outside perspectives of everyone else, but he kind of, the way we see him interacting with Mary Kelly and then just kind of talking to all his coworkers, you get a sense of who he is as a person.
And you know what else I like? After that transfer, I mean, he does, like, the joking around complaining about how shitty Whitechapel is, but he doesn't complain about being there. He doesn't complain about his job. He just sits to the task and does it. I love that about him. Like, that moment that he comes back and says 14 fucking years, he's utterly destroyed. But he wakes up the next day, goes to Whitechapel, and does his fucking job. I love that. The other guy I kind of like in this and feel so, so sorry for is Netley.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He totally gets dragged into something that he is not prepared for or qualified to handle.
No. I hate how he's basically Gull's toy, because Gull is, like, so mean to him, too.
I know. It tells him he's stupid right to his face. Like, and, like, that's what he says. And Netley even says, oh, you like me because I'm dumb. Or I don't think. You know? And it's like, buddy, have a little confidence in yourself. You're a good cab driver.
And it's always, like, complete unwitting, too, because Gull will say a thing like, do you know why I like you, Netley? And Netley will be like, I'm not sure, sir. And Gull's like, exactly.
It's like,
oh, man, the guy doesn't even know he's being mocked. And it's actually really easy to see how the psychological, like, terrors of the architecture that Gull inflicted upon him were able to make him participate in these murders, because if you're that dumb and you think, like, there's this giant, I guess he probably was thinking satanic conspiracy out to get him that he can't stop, he's not going to object or provide a logical reason why this is crazy.
Yeah, that's probably one of the other functions that chapter 4 serves, is that the entire time they're getting driven around, Netley is the one driving. And by Gull showing him everything, it's kind of him saying, I've brought you into this, and now you cannot get out. And I think he's using his intellect to say a bunch of things that sound really convincing. And my or not might be true. Saying it all to Netley, to let Netley think, like, there's nowhere you can run. Like, we have built this town, this order runs everything, and you're in it, and you cannot get out, and you cannot say no.
See, I kind of thought of it slightly differently, that he was just using, he was, like, showing Netley, like, look at this big world that you're going to now be a part of. Welcome to the big boys club kind of thing. Like, using big, you know, using the same kind of thing, like big words and huge ideas to impress Netley into becoming part of the big boys club.
Yeah, that's true. You're going to be a member of Masonic Legend.
Oh, yeah, he does say that. That's
That's
a good way to sell it.
That's true, because he drives around and says, you're going to be a part of all this, buddy. All this. See how we're everywhere? You're going to be part of it.
I think it's both. I mean, he starts off being like, you're going to be so cool, and you're going to move up in the world, and you won't have to be a cabbie anymore. And then he drives him into having such a bad panic attack that he barfs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gull, I feel, really calculated that one out, and that's scary, because it's just so cold.
Yeah. And then I sympathize him with him so much, because he's in this position. He can't really get out, and he knows what he's doing is wrong, but from his point of view, it has to be done. I mean, he's selfishly doing it, I think, for his career and the Masons that he's imagining he'll have and all that kind of stuff. But I like that it's reinforced when he always says, is this the last one? Can we please be done after this? Please tell me we're done. can we just finish this all tonight? He's like, why do we have to do all of this stuff? Why can't we just go one after the other and get them all tonight? That's what makes me feel like he feels trapped, that there's no way out for him. Is that he constantly doesn't want to be a part of it. He wants the benefits, but he doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, and he knows, like, in his heart that it's wrong, and then he has this crazy man being like, what you're doing is a good thing and a good deed. And he's just like, I need out of this situation, because it's, it's really dissonant in one's head. If you're doing something bad and then you think it's good and you don't know what to believe.
Yeah. So are there any other characters in this that stuck out to you in any way?
It's, I think, weird. We should talk about Lee's a little bit. I mean, he's... We get him... He bookends the story with Aberline, right?
Yeah, in my head I call him Psych. Because that's what he is. Have you seen that show, David?
I have not.
You haven't seen Pasich?
I have never seen Pasich.
Oh, God. It's a good funny show. It's a good if you don't want to think show. Have you seen it, Jen?
No, but I really liked how you pronounced that.
Alpasich, yeah.
Yes.
That's what it is. But yeah, so that in that show, basically, there's a guy who is really, really perceptive about details that other people aren't. And he, as a job, becomes a psychic investigator. And whenever he sees details that click together in his head, he pretends to have a psychic episode where he, like, spazzes out and then spews out what's actually reason, but he does it as though he's seeing a vision. And that's pretty much exactly what Leeds does. So I kind of think maybe, like, somebody had a weird sense of humor when they were reading from hell and decided to make the show Psych. But that's what I call him in my head. But that was a neat thing, how I like how up front Alan Moore tells us that all of Lee's visions are fake. They're all fake. Every last one. Completely fake. Even the down to the wetting his pants. And then we see the visions and we're like, oh, you're just... Now I see why they're fake.
But it's weird, too, because he does say, like, I made them all up and then they all came true.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be like, what?
That's pretty eerie.
Yeah, my only problem with Lee's is that I feel like, okay, we see him in the prologue, but I feel like his entry into the main story was very abrupt. And I don't know if it's supposed to just feel like serendipitous, like he kind of just appears luckily, and then he and Aberline, you know, actually get to meet because the police officers aren't just saying, like, go home, you crazy guy, and then Aberline listens to him and it works out, or if it's supposed to be... I don't know. It seemed very strange that a man who knew he was a fake psychic would be going to the police and saying, like, I know who this is. And the thing, too, is he sets up Gull out of spite. So it's like he knows he's doing a spiteful thing, and then it just turns out okay. There's so many weird facets to that.
But, I mean, is that... In my head, that's a little bit chicken and the egg. Like, because you don't like Gull, there's something about that guy. Like, this is what gets me about this kind of psychic stuff, right? It's handy that it just so happens to be the murder and all that, but even if he went there, a guy with that kind of personality, you think might be doing something wrong anyway. Right? Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
But, you're right. He does go in and specifically say, I know who Jack the Ripper is. And takes him straight to Gull.
And I think it's unclear in the story, but it seems like he comes in the first time and is like, I know who it is. And they say, go away. And then Gull pisses him off and he, like, kind of snaps and is like, I'm going to take out this dude.
I'm going to go pretend to have a fucking seizure.
So it almost feels like he tries it first without maybe knowing what he's doing, or just planning to make something up on the spot, and then it just magically works out. Like, it does feel like magic. Mm. And I think some of that is purposeful, but on the other hand, it seems so jarring.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of it feeling like magic, it would be magic that undoes Gull, a guy who feels like he's completely bound in reason. That's good play and irony there. if it's purposeful. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have really a lot to say about Lee's. He doesn't have, aside from him faking the episodes and stuff, he doesn't really have a ton of personality in my head. I like that he doesn't get killed at the end.
I think part of what I was going to say is part of the reason why he's relevant is he's one of the two that like makes it out alive.
Mm-hmm. I'm a little sad though, because there's four that make it out alive. It's these two, Marie Kelly and the girl. And I'm kind of, I like that we don't see Mary Kelly, but I kind of would like to know what happened to that little girl.
Yeah.
Like, does she live a normal life somewhere?
Does she know who her dad is?
Yeah. Like, I kind of want to know what happens to her. I like not knowing about Mary Kelly. And I like that the fact that she's alive is just told secondhand by other eyewitnesses. Like, oh, no, I saw her after the murder. I saw her. I like that. And it's corroborated with multiple people. And it's like, well, that's the evidence that you need, Aberline, right there. But I kind of would like to have seen the other girl in terms of people who survived.
Yeah, me too.
So we already mentioned the art a little bit. Let's actually get in and talk about it. What did you guys think of this art style?
I didn't like it at first. And then as the book progressed, I started to like it more and more. It definitely fits the story. Alan Moore picked the right person to draw this comic. It has the right atmosphere and just the right amount.
Eddie Campbell.
Eddie Campbell does an amazing job of putting the details in the most effective places. I don't want to say the right places, because there were sometimes it was like, this is too much detail for me. But it was effective storytelling through the art and the right amount of detail.
I thought it was really interesting that in normal comics, like, line work is so incredibly prevalent. You know, we see all these crisp lines and then they're colored in. But then here, there was very little line work except where it was absolutely necessary to, like, for instance, distinguish the profile of someone's face from the background. And most everything was just made up out of clumps of shadows. And the line work that went into those shadows was so precise and at the same time looked so incredibly messy. It did a really good job of portraying how, I think, dark and dirty East End London is supposed to look, and how dark and kind of mysterious this story is meant to be.
Yeah, I think I'm the opposite from you, David. I started out liking this art, being like, oh, this is going to be a murder mystery kind of thing with Jack the Ripper, and this art style is going to be really, really cool. And then I got, like, through part of it, and I'm like, I cannot distinguish one woman from another. They all look the same, but the story revolves around four women. I don't know who the fuck is who. Who's talking? I mean, that's why they have to constantly call each other by their names. It's because I cannot tell one from the other. And I think that's not necessarily the ability of the artist so much as it is the style that's employed here. You know, like, the men are distinguished by their facial hair, by the different kinds of mustaches and beards that they have, but this art style has a real hard time distinguishing one woman from another, and that got really, really frustrating until they started dying off, and I'm like, okay, now I know who's left. It's one of these two. But, like, up until then, it was really frustrating. And the only time I felt like that had weight for the comic was when they confused identities, right? And I'm like, well, yeah, it makes sense, because Gol doesn't know who any of these women are. We shouldn't know who any of these women, what they look like. We shouldn't be able to distinguish them any better than him or Netley does, except by the things that Netley gives them. And then at the same time, when the one gets cut up because she picks the wrong false name and has that stroke of bad luck, like, then it makes sense to me that there's, okay, I can't tell them apart any more than they can't tell them apart. And I think that's kind of plays into these people in East End are just all so so downtrodden, and they all just kind of live together in huddled masses. Like, they say over and over, like, how many houses there are, in, like, how many, like, boarding houses there are in East End, and how many people are in each house, and it's like, there's just these masses of poor people there, and they're all faceless to the upper-class structure. Whereas the upper class recognizes everybody else by name, and they call each other Sir This, Mr. That, all these other things, but down in East End, where everybody's faceless, they have whatever name they want that day. And so the art, like, helped that sort of feeling, but at the same time, I got really annoyed, because I'm like, which one of these is Polly? I don't even really know. But it worked in all the places it needed to. Like, the scene where Mary Kelly gets cut up is just so fucking gruesome. Oh my god. The blood everywhere.
Yeah.
That was horrid.
I could not look at the pages where her breast was just, like, lying on the table. I could not look at those.
That was not fun to watch. Like, no. Oh gosh. Very unhappy.
So it's like, there are times when the art just clicked and it made you feel the thing you were supposed to feel at that time. But there are other times when I was like, what is even happening in this panel? It's just like all black lines. I think it's a building.
Yeah. I mean, I was pretty confused about what the hell was happening the night when two women got killed. Like, yeah. He drags one into the courtyard and doesn't finish. But, like, it was really strange because we see the two of them in their, like, going about their day before that, and it was a little hard to distinguish, even from the text paired with the art, who was being killed at that time.
And, like I said, I don't know if that's purposeful or not, because that evening was a frenzy for Gull and Netley. You know, like, they just up and did it. It was just like, okay, well, let's go, let's do it right now, let's go. You know? And so, does that play into it? Or, like, does that confusion in the art add to that effect or not? And I think I'm with you, Jen. I think I was just more confused than anything in that, and it didn't, like, help me feel what Gull was, his position or Natalie, and it just, I was just like, I kind of want to know what's actually happening here, because this is a really integral part of the story, and I'm kind of, like, bought into this Jack the Ripper crime, like, story going through. I'm like, I'm bought in now, and now you're not showing me things. What did you guys think of the framing structure on the pages? They're all 3x3, pretty much, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I thought it was good for. There was so much discussion in these that in this comic that this framing method worked really well, and you know, you could just have two dudes sitting across from tables one another with huge word bubbles on either side, and that would be horrible. So this, what's great about this one is they can have one conversation take like 12 or 18 or 24 frames, and as you go through, the artist can, and Eddie Campbell does this, he focuses on different details in the story, especially when you get to like chapter 12 or so, when the Masons become pretty, like, a lot of the other Masons start to show up, and, you know, you'll have like this conversation happening, and then the last one will focus on the Masonic ring or something like that. And you can also see how people's mood and reactions happen throughout the conversation. So I liked it. You know, it makes it, there's a lot going on in a single page because there's lots of different frames, but I think for a text-heavy comic like this, it works really well.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, how, because there's so much dialogue happening in this, that having, like, a full panel spread would be really difficult, or a full page spread. You would get that, what comic was it, Hush? When the Joker reveals the entire plan.
just a
wall of text, and you're like, yeah.
The Riddler.
Riddler, yeah. Like, that really wouldn't work in this. Because in this one, you turn the page and you're like, okay, there's a lot of words here, but it's chunked up. You know, like when you get a really thick book and like, okay, but there's 58 chapters, but they're all 4 pages. You know, it's kind of that same feeling. Whereas like if it was 58, or if it was, I don't know, 58 chapters and they were all 100 pages, like, oh, fuck this. You know, yeah, you're right.
I think the art is so
vague in places that it's important to have that rigid sense of framing. Mm-hmm. And the text is vague in places. Sometimes you really can't tell who's saying what, and you have to very carefully follow along to get the gist of a conversation. And doing this is interesting because when you have those, like, you know, three panels laid out, you can zoom in, zoom out, and it actually, in this case, I think, offered more flexibility than the more standard types of framing we see would have. Because we're not just limited to, like, you know, maybe one or two cuts of a room with some large slanted panels or something. We see almost like looking at a TV screen. So it's kind of zooming in, zooming out. It's replicating a very linear way of looking at things, which was nice. It added good structure.
Yeah. You know, I went into recording thinking, man, I'm a big fan of playing with frames. I'm a big fan of J.H. Williams III and stuff like that, where, like, you integrate the layout of the page into the storytelling. And I really think that that's kind of something that has been underutilized in comics for a really long time and is just now starting to get the kind of emphasis it deserves. And I was sitting there thinking, man, this feels so old. And then I reminded, oh, yeah, it's from 1989. It is old. And after hearing you guys, like, I'm like, yeah, it's old school, but it really, really works for this comic. It really, really fits the way that this comic looks around and things. So basically, I agree with you guys.
Thank you.
Yay, we are in accordance.
So I'm not sure that I have anything more to say about this. Let me ask you guys. So I recently moved to an area where I'm now taking the light rail to work, and I noticed when I got up, I read this on the train on the way to work, and I noticed that when I got up and turned around and started to walk out, the woman behind me, as I left, was giving me a really weird look, and I realized it's because I passed a couple really explicit panels when I was reading on the light rail.
Yeah, so I was actually reading this in public as well, because I had to take somebody to the doctor, and so I was sitting in the doctor's office reading this, and there was a window behind me where people in the hallway could see what I was reading, potentially. So when I got to certain pages, I would, like, pull the book closer to myself. So it was so easy to see what I was doing, because there were some of the pages with, like, Joe and Mary Kelly, where it's like, okay, probably don't want people to know that I'm, I don't know what people would think if they knew, if they, all they got was that frame or something of, like, a penis or something.
Oh yeah, that frame where the old guy gets jerked off in the hot tub.
Yeah, actually that was one that I crossed as I was, yeah.
And that one's bad because it's not even a sex scene. It's just a big dick. Like, and this is kind of something I go back and forth with in comics. Like, in this one, it kind of, like, I get why it's there. East End is dirty. These people are dirty. The things they do, I mean, this is the base parts of life that these people are concerned with. It's not William Gull. William Gull is completely cerebral. I don't even know if he makes love to his wife. I doubt it. If he does, he puts some Apollonian Diana thing on it, probably. Like, his sex is really up in his head. But, like, these people is very practical. These people, all they have to deal with are the bottom of the pyramid of needs in life, right? And so I get why we're shown in such detail. Like, I understand it. Why it's there. It makes sense from an artistic standpoint. But I really don't like reading in public when it's like that. So I have this weird back and forth, because as much as I see why it needs to be there, it makes reading this comic uncomfortable, and not in a way that it should. I think I should feel uncomfortable seeing that big dick in that page, right?
So a note, I read this in the privacy of my own home.
Yeah.
And I'm not a prude, but that comic made me really uncomfortable. I felt voyeuristic, and I felt like I was seeing something I shouldn't have been, like I was intruding on a private moment, mm-hmm. and it felt creepy, and by the end I was desensitized to it.
And I think that's intentional. I think that's the way you're kind of supposed to feel
mm-hmm.
in this art.
I think
art.
So, too.
And I think I got a little bit of that, and then immediately I thought, oh, fuck, the people around me can read this. And that moment that I had was just poof, gone. And so I go back and forth in my head, because this is something, it does it really well, what it's supposed to do. But that's not the reaction that I get when I read it in public. And I don't know where other people stand on this, where you guys stand on this, but like, this kind of vulgarity in comics has a place, yes, but it makes it hard to read. Because I don't like sit at home and read leisurely all the time. I read when I can. I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted to bring this out either in public or, like, even around my roommates. I don't think I would have been comfortable with people in the room.
Yeah, have somebody walk by and be like, "Oh, Jen, what are you reading? What
the hell are you doing?" Yeah, exactly.
You have to immediately start defending yourself. I don't know. So that's the only last thing I had to talk about with this. Did you guys have anything else, or should we get down to rating it?
I think I'm good to rate it.
Yeah.
All right. Who wants to go first?
I will.
All right, Jen, you go first.
So when I started this, I had serious doubts that I was going to be able to rate it highly, and I wanted to because I really do like Alan Moore's work. You know, everything from like Swamp Thing to Watchmen, I've really enjoyed. And this did not let me down. I feel like the payoff at the end of the comic was really good, and it was like after maybe chapter 5, a very suspenseful and moving read. I mean, there were times when I kind of felt like horfing reading this, and that's pretty intense because when I read comics, I try to like shut off that part of my head. So I'll see something and be like, okay, it's just a comic. But here it felt really visceral and real, just the way I think it was intended to be. And I feel like this comic had a bit of a strange intent, but it got that intent through very clearly, and that it fulfilled its purpose, whatever that purpose may be. So I'm going to go ahead and give this a 5. And I almost said 4.5 just because of the slow beginning, but I feel like that was calculated in as well. So I think that this is one of those comics that deserves the highest of ratings because it is such a thought out and crafted work of art, even though it's super unpleasant.
How about you, David?
Okay, so usually when we start recording an episode, I kind of have an idea in my head of what score I'm gonna give a comic, and this one I had no idea. I thought about it. I actually finished reading it last night and spent all day thinking about it, and I kind of went back and forth. Like, I think overall, definitely, I thought this was an enjoyable read. Like Jen, I think this is an extremely well-crafted work of writing that is paired with some excellent and very appropriate to the story artwork. This is definitely a graphic novel in every sense of the word. Like Jen, I feel like we all had a similar reading experience. I felt that the beginning was kind of slow, and then, like I said before, in chapter 4, it was just such a bog to read through. And maybe now that we've talked about it so much, maybe that was, I mean, definitely that was the point, and made us kind of, to make the readers kind of feel like Netley must have felt in this journey all day long riding around London while this dude just, who knows what the hell he's talking about, right? And so this was a very interesting experience for reading a comic. You know, I read comics every week and I read all kinds of stuff. I mean, typically it's superhero stuff, but I read other things here and there too. I'm going to agree with Jen and go with a 5. It's hard to say why, other than that, like Jen said too, this is just such a well put together piece of artwork. You know, this is definitely, I feel like this is one of the high points in comic books. This is a really good comic, and it's unfortunate now that you don't hear about it that much. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, people talk about Watchmen and V for Vendetta all the time. And, you know, I feel like this is a comic that deserves more attention. But if you're going to read this comic, just beware of the artwork. You might just know what you're getting yourself into, so don't read it in
public. Just read it at home.
Yeah. No, I feel like 5 is the right score for this comic. So don't mess this up, Andy.
Oh, God. You know, because, all right, I had such an experience trying to read this comic. I finished it about 20 minutes before we started recording, and I didn't really have a lot of time to process it on my own until we sat and talked about it. And as Jen was talking, I was like, oh, yeah, Swamp Thing, because you mentioned Swamp Thing. And I'm like, that is still, even after this, that's the best thing by Alan Moore I think I've read. I loved Swamp Thing, and I like it better than this. And that made me think, that's DC, right? Maybe it's, I think it's Vertigo at that point, but that's basically, that's DC and them giving him an editor. And I'm thinking, like, what would this comic have been like with an editor? Because I think this was Alan Moore, and Alan Moore picking an artist, and Alan Moore said, I'm going to make this grand graphic novel of a tale. And it's going to be art with a capital A. And I think, if with an editor, this would have been better. And so then I was like, yeah, 3.5, maybe. Maybe 3.5 or 4. Because pacing is really important for a story. But then you were talking, David, about how this is not... I've never read a book like this. I've never read anything like this comic before. I've never read a Batman story like this. I've never read a crime story like this. I've never read a noir story. This is unique. In the complete sense of the word, this graphic novel is unique. And I always like to reward uniqueness with my ratings. I think I gave Promethea like a 4.5. And looking back, that was way too much. But I felt like she as a character and that story were unique. And this is also unique. And I think that's going to make me give it four and a half. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I'm sorry, I fucked it up.
That's okay.
Because it's so close. It's so close to being perfect. Not just it's because it's unique, but this is crafted, like you said, Jen, from beginning to end. This comic is intentional. I feel like every step of this comic is intentional. And yeah, David, you're right. In chapter 4, we go through with Netley and get sucked into that hole the same way he does, and that feeling of, oh, God, just keep rambling on, old fuck. But I don't... Yeah, 4.5. I'm just going to leave it at that and stop rambling. So that was our listener request. If any of you have a listener request, you're welcome to send them in. But we don't have one for next week. So next week we're going to start an arc called Marvel Youngins. Since we did Teen Titans, I'm like, okay, we read a bunch of young teen characters from the DC. I feel like we should do some young Marvel characters. So we're going to read Young Avengers Sidekicks. This is the run from 2005. It collects Young Avengers 1 to 6 by Alan Heinberg. And then we're going to read the new Young Avengers, which is titled Style Over Substance. That collects Young Avengers 1 to 5. And a thing from Marvel Now, I don't know, I can't figure out what the Marvel Now thing is, but if you buy the trade, it's supposed to be in there. And this is the 5 issues by Kieran Gillen. I think that's how you pronounce it. I don't know. It's Irish, right? Kieran Gillen. And then we're going to wrap up with Wolverine and the X-Men. And that collects Wolverine and the X-Men issues 1 to 4 from 2011 by Jason Aaron. And hopefully those will be really fun because I feel like I need something uplifting after this. This thing was heavy and I really just want people shooting spitballs at Wolverine's back. But if you have a listener request, you can let us know at our email address.
Which is atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
And if you're just going to send stuff, make sure we haven't done it before. And you can do that by going to www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. On the right, there's a button that says Past Shows. Click on that bad boy. Make sure we haven't done it before. Or if you think we did it before and you listened to that episode and you think, man, that was shit. You guys are totally wrong. You can hit us up on social media and tell us. Tell us at facebook.com/APSupercast, twitter.com/APSupercast, or apsupercast.tumblr.com. Yeah, that's all them social medias. At least all the ones we're going to do because I don't want to do anything else. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
All right. Until next week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye. man, that comic left a, like, shadow on my brain.
I know, I really meant it. I cannot wait to read Young Avengers.
Yeah.
I really want to see some capes and bright colors.
I need levity.
Like, I want to go read Justice League International right now.